talk a little bit about the legal stuff, and then we'll do a question and answer. What is LIVID? LIVID is a little acronym I came up with for the Linux video and DVD project. We just took a couple of the characters and made a short word out of it. I started working to build this project after I got interested in the documentation for the Matrox G200 chipset. After working on the Utah GLX project, which was the 3D project that was a predecessor to LIVID, we realized that there were a lot of hardware accelerations, and then there was a DVD add-on module to the G200 that we had all the pieces that we needed from a technical standpoint, documentation, to actually play DVDs on Linux. And so my original intent was only to bring support for that one chipset, the chipset that was on the DVD add-on for the Matrox card for Linux. Then the project kind of exploded. People started joining on, saying, hey, you know, not everyone has that chip, or, you know, there's all these other hardware decoders out there. Let's build a nice architecture for a player to where we could plug in different pieces for hardware acceleration, or just do a full software decoded DVD player, and then everyone would be able to use it. The Linux video and DVD project. After exploding to the big idea of how it came, you know, how people wanted to make a software DVD player to support multiple hardware decoders, multiple video cards, we started creating little sub-projects within the big project. We added the BTTV project, which focused on the TV tuning, and there was a correlation there between the display libraries and some of the APIs that we were working on that it made sense to go ahead and bring that in. The video editing pieces haven't really gotten off the ground. The pending legal situation has kind of put a damper on the development of the project. I'll talk a little bit more about that later. The DVD player, and of course, we wanted to add support for various media formats. We added support for MP3. Eventually, we'll add support for like AVI, MPEG-1, VCDs. So the way the program is architected, we can plug in modules for any format that we get or find specifications for. An interesting sub-project that hasn't gotten anywhere, mostly due to the pending litigation, is the open video disc format. The idea here was to create a full suite of authoring, encoding, and decoding programs that were all based on open video standards, open audio standards, and that was going to be the open video disc. The idea here was to create a better specification than what DVD had, offer it up, and allow people to use that for free, gratis and libre, for those of you familiar with the open source terms. And the project can be found at linuxvideo.org. CSS is the content scrambling system. This is the part that was the most difficult to come across, and then also the one that the piece of the DVD decoding puzzle that caused all our problems with the legal situation. CSS is the process that the DVD forum came up with for content encryption and then access control on DVDs. CSS has two main parts. One is the disk and decoder authentication, and then the other is actually the content encryption. When a disk is placed in a DVD drive, you can't actually read any data off if the DVD is encrypted until you pass the handshake challenge. There's a challenge that goes on there, and the idea there is to make sure that there's a decoder that's ready to take DVD data from an appropriate disk. So this key exchange goes on. This was known as CSS auth, this is made up of 40-bit keys. Same thing as the content encryption. The content encryption was mostly play protection. On any given DVD movie, only about 20% of the sectors on the disc are encrypted. They did this because it would have put too much of a strain on software decoders if they had to decrypt every sector on the disc. So instead of encrypting all the content. They only encrypt about 20%. At 20%, that's just enough that you can't skip the encrypted sectors and put together any viewable picture. CSS fails to really do what it was set out to do. Encryption doesn't really apply to media content protection very well. The problem really stems to the fact that once you play a movie or play some audio like music or anything like that, at the very end, your audio or your video is in full decoded. It's in the raw mode. You can sit there and videotape it. You're on a speaker. If you're playing audio, you can just record it right off the speaker wire. So all encryption does is add a layer of obfuscation. What's that word? Obfuscation. It adds a layer of obfuscation to the whole process. And so it really doesn't do what it was intentionally set out to do. The recording industry and the motion picture industry have this false sense that encryption, this magic buzzword, is just going to solve all their problems, when in fact it doesn't do what they want it to. I actually came across a plugin on Windows for DirectX where instead of being a video driver, it was a video capture driver, and so anything that played to this alleged video device was actually just being recorded back to the system. And this is a clear example of how CSS fails. You can go through the whole process, everything looks legitimate, and they're going to write to the display driver, and in reality it's just capturing the images back to disk. We can do the same thing on Linux using XV drivers or X drivers or even just raw access. So this just goes to show how they really didn't do their homework. They really don't understand the technical aspects of it, and CSS was really put out there just to block access control and prevent something such as an open source project from being able to play DVDs. OMS. OMS was actually the second incarnation of the DVD player to come out of the Livid project. OMS stands for Open Media System. The first incarnation was known as NIST, and it was really more of a proof of concept. We just kind of plugged in different pieces of the puzzle to see if we could actually do the entire process. Once we were able to prove that, we went back to the drawing board and said, you know, let's design a properly modulated system, something where we can add acceleration at any piece in the process. And that's where Open Media System came from. Multiple displays, output plugins, input plugins, codec plugins. We could take advantage of any hardware acceleration. If your sound card could support AC97 audio out, fine, we'll plug it there. If your video card can do discrete cosine transforms or any other layer of the DVD in decrypting or decoding, we would want to take advantage of that. And it would drastically improve performance and provide compatibility on any chipset that we could come, any chipset that was on the market. Here's a quick diagram demonstrating the architecture of OMS. It's kind of small. I don't know if most of y'all see it. This is available on the linuxvideo.org website. You basically start out with the inputs. Depending on what the format is we're doing, we'll do a demuxing if it's DVD, and we'll handle the audio and the video separately. But the main idea here was to provide a real, or the main idea was to design a real architecture here. We wanted to standardize outputs, we wanted to standardize inputs, and then plug in everything else there. OMS would also provide multiple ways to display or the user interface. We'd have multiple ways. You could have a GTK interface. You could have an NCURSIS interface. You could have a QT interface. With the SDL output plugin, we could actually support Windows. And at one time, there was talk about providing support for Mac OS X. OMS DVD, this was the most actively developed part of OMS for obvious reasons. Currently, due to the litigation and all the legal battles that have been going on, many of the Livid developers have slowed their development. Some have even ceased. It's safe to say that the MPAA did a good job at scaring a lot of them off. Eventually, we'll have full synchronous audio-video. All the hooks are there in the architecture. X has got some really nice things that we found out later about that will help us with time synchronization. Audio-video synchronization is probably the most difficult problem in doing a DVD player. the time stamping and the different supported, what is it? And MPEG-2, you've got very different streams, and different streams can be set up in different ways. And so it's very difficult to get this audio-video synchronization, especially with multiple processor speeds, hardware decoding in some areas. If you're doing audio here or video here, you get accelerations at different points. And so this is a very difficult problem to make just a generalized system that'll make sure the audio and video is synchronized. Drivers exist right now for multiple decoder cards, including the DXR2, which is from Creative Labs. The DXR3 and the Hollywood Plus are actually based on the same chipset, so support for that chip is available. And then the Zoran chipset is the chipset that was found on the Matrox DVD decoder module. We've got beta support for that. I've talked a little bit about the multiple layers, levels of acceleration, back-end scalar color conversion, motion compensation, all these things. We wanted to have plugins, so if your video card said, I support this, I don't support this, that we would offload that to hardware for better performance. We did have an X11 output plugin. It's pretty scary, just straight drawing to X. It's really slow for anyone that's done any programming on X Windows. This is what DVD looks like in OMS. One of the interesting pieces that I really liked that one of the developers added was the idea of DVD-DB, which is similar to the CD-DB database, to where you put in a disk and you hit an internet site and it automatically downloads, you know, for your CD it has your title, all the track names and everything like that, so you don't have to program them in. Well, we were going to do the same thing with DVD, and there's a limited database out there for that, to where you can plop a DVD, drop a DVD into your drive. It'll query a remote server, bring back the title and all the names of the chapters and everything on your disk. Just kind of neat. Again, this is available on the website. I don't know if you guys really want me to get into the intricacies of decoding DVD, but you can see we read it in. We hit the buffers. We've got display libraries, decoding plugins on the far right, where you plug in the MPEG-2 AC3D, and then eventually go out to your output display library, whatever you want to use. I get this question a lot. Why DVD? DVD was a really new technology when I first started working on it. It was very interesting to me to see what we could do with it on Linux. Obviously, the movie piece of it was a major piece of the Linux desktop puzzle that wasn't available at the time, and that was something I was very interested in working towards, was completing all the things on the Linux desktop to make it compete actively with the Windows. The high capacity format for it was it's very neat to think what you could do on the authoring side as a home user, creating content yourself, being able to distribute it. This project was probably one of the biggest undertakings that I've worked on. And it was also a very nasty project from an open source project management standpoint. It's a fairly large undertaking. We were dealing with multiple vendors, multiple hardware decoders, multiple display libraries. Acceleration and optimization was very tedious. And the AV synchronization is a really hairy, nasty problem. I'd put coding for video second or third, the most difficult thing to do, right up there with 3D and then kernel programming. Here's a little bit more about Open Video Disc. I'd really like to see this going. I think this is a really neat idea. I think that with the right people back on the project, we could really make some inroads with this, create a great format for people to create content at their house, distribute it, make a format that would work for streaming as well as straight movie production. Various video audio formats supported. The idea you could plug in MPEG-3 for your audio or AUG or any of those other ones that you wanted was very interesting. We wouldn't add any CSS. I just don't think we'd do that. And then we'd make a free encoder and player available, obviously, to everybody. other software that came into the project. We kind of brought some of these projects under the Livid umbrella. The MGA video project, Matrox released specifications and documentation for several of their hardware encoder and decoder cards. And so there was a lot of work done on the Rainbow Runner and the Matrix Marvel. The GATOS project, one of the most active still today projects, supports the ATI TV cards, the All in Wonders, and their various product line. And then the BTTV project is probably the most known video project with support for a lot of the TV cards that are on the market that are based on the Brooktree TV chipset. The goals of the project still stand. I'd like to think that once a lot of the legal situation clears up, that we'll be able to get back on track with development, get back to where we wanted to be. I would have really liked to see where we would be now had none of the legal situation been brought up. There were a lot of good ideas running around. We had a lot of really smart developers, and it was very unfortunate that the turn of events. The full-featured DVD player, obviously, is something that we wanted to create a great player for the Linux platform that all the distributions could use, create a standardized media player across several platforms, and make it very easy for people to add different formats or play formats with in a very light and modular fashion so it wouldn't be very bloated. So if you just wanted to open up a player to play MP3s, it wouldn't have to necessarily use or load all the pieces to do DVD, which is a very heavy process. The video editing suite part, we don't have any projects or any code yet for any of that, but that was one of the goals that we wanted to do, eventually create DVD authoring software or software for authoring other video and audio formats. The tightly integrated video APIs was something else. Currently on Linux, the display outputs and the video device APIs are pretty antiquated. There's a lot of stuff that's going into the kernel. Someone's calling me. Turn that off. There's a lot of stuff that's into the kernel now that's very outdated. And there was a lot of work and a lot of good ideas on how to start cleaning that up and start getting a lot of that into the core kernel. We were able to get the DVD I/O controls into the 2.4 kernel, and that was one of our our biggest feats, was getting that in before 2.4 came out. So 2.4 would have to have no patches to play DVDs. I'm going to go ahead and show you a quick demo. I loaded OMS up before I left, and unfortunately I have a newer version of X Windows, and the ATI driver on my laptop causes it to crash. So I went ahead and pulled down one of the other DVD programs that is based on a lot of the libraries from the Livid project, a program called Xine, X-I-N. It's on SourceForge. Plays pretty decently from what I've seen. And that's another thing that's been pretty neat about our project. Although our development has slowed, a lot of the work that was done on our project in regards to the AC3 libraries, which are for decoding the DVD audio, and the MPEG-2 libraries, which were for DVD video, were picked up by other projects and other groups that were working on similar DVD players. And so there's a lot of code out there that's still being used, and all the current DVD players that really came out of the Livid project. With the adding of XV acceleration, video is a lot smoother. And the quality is really good. This just goes to show what an open source project can do when they get their minds to it, and when you get a lot of really bright and smart and dedicated people together. There really isn't a computing task that cannot be accomplished. That's all right. I'll stop for a couple minutes. I think we most of us have seen this movie. Yeah, we'll let him jump. You think he makes it this time? I'm pretty shocked he didn't make it. Almost as shocked as yesterday when I found out my girlfriend hadn't seen Star Wars. I know. I don't know what I'm going to do about it. She's the one sitting over there all embarrassed. I thought we were going to get kicked out of the convention. All right, let's talk about the fun stuff, stuff that's kind of slowed down our project. Has anyone here not heard of DECSS? DECSS is the Windows program that was developed that initially did the decryption of the video content. The algorithm inside the DECS program proper was what we needed for Linux. And we get this question a lot, is why was DECSS originally written for Windows? And it's very simple. The DVD I/O controls and the UDF file system support on Linux wasn't mature enough or stable enough to do that kind of work. And so the original work was done on Windows. That was done by a group of software engineers in Europe and released by a Norwegian teenager named John Johannesson. This was in the middle of 1999. Since then, several court cases sprung up. Most of you are probably aware of the big one in New York, which is based on the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, or the DMCA. The DMCA has caused a lot of fun for a lot of technology products, and Napster and Dimitri and a lot of encryption research has been challenged by this law. Talk a little bit about where the court cases are, funding and support for these efforts. There's my DECSS slide I didn't get to. I talked about this already, so I'm just going to skip it. Impact. The impact, if these precedents get set, if the MPAA wins in a lot of these cases, is pretty scary. The hampering of fair use is one of the bigger ones. The CSS process and the way DVDs are set up, it really limits the ability for a regular consumer to exercise his fair use for the content that he purchased. You can't make a copy of that disc for backup or archival purposes. You can't fast forward through parts of the movie that's actually in the specification itself. And things like that really hamper what the consumer can do with it. And when they buy a DVD disc, they're limited to what the motion picture industry lets them do with it. And at that point, they're really changing past law and past precedents that have been set. Future technologies, especially cryptography research and projects working on cryptography, are going to be seriously hampered if the current laws or the currently pending cases stand up. Then there's also the really hairy scenario revolving source code and free speech aspects of it. This again goes towards development of technology and a lot about computer research. The fair use piece, it is legal to make a copy of a disc. It is legal to fast forward through the FBI warning and all commercials on a movie disc. The other thing this limited us to doing with CSS is we couldn't do really neat things with the program. There were two main features we wanted to build into our player that kind of would have stood out from other ones. One of them was we wanted to be able to play the movie backwards, just read it, play it backwards, and see what happens. The other one was we got this idea from one of the developers at Carnegie Mellon, also worked on the project, the speech recognition project known as Sphinx, and we wanted to plug in some Sphinx stuff just because we thought it would have been neat to use Sphinx for something. We wanted to be able to build an index on a movie, and you could say, I want to go to the part of the movie where Jack Nicholson says, "You can't handle the truth," and boom, you'd be there. And it would be at the exact frame, or a frame before, obviously it'd be setting up a flag, in that movie. And it's a little bit different than what you have now with chapters or the subtitles. We could be a little more precise, or we get a little bit more of a buffer left or right where we want to do with it. The free speech argument is a pretty fun one. I talked a lot about this yesterday. The idea that if I write a program in a language called C, and I use that as my way of communicating to other software engineers, how is that different than if I verbally tell him the algorithm or verbally tell him what my program is doing? And there's a lot of legislative and case history a little bit before that where several things were supported in the idea that software programs are language or have expressive content. Where we had a recent change in that idea was when Judge Kaplan in the New York case came down saying that, yes, there is expressive value to the content, but where computer programs are different is that they also perform a function. And this causes a lot of problems, especially in what we were doing with the DVDs. This is a little bit different than what Napster did. Napster has a program that just goes out there and grabs the content for you. With DECSS, this was a tool that could be used for legitimate purposes, creating an open source DVD player, and it could also be used for making a copy of a movie. And where Judge Kaplan really had a shortfalling was in recognizing that this tool had legitimate uses and should be supported under the expressive in the free speech argument. But he failed to do that. He failed to make that connection. And this is one of the areas that we're working on to try to turn around. This is a funny story. I told this yesterday, and I want to, for anyone that wasn't here, tell it again. When I was in New York for one of the Linux conventions, this was in February of 2000, we had a panel of lawyers and speakers, and one of them that was there was one of the co-authors of the DMCA. And I posed this very question to him. I asked him, you know, where does the DMCA support for computer software code the expressive content of source code or the expressive value even of the binary of the machine code? And he really didn't have a good answer. He fought around in his head a little bit and couldn't figure out the differences between source code and binaries. And then he asked me the question. He said, you know, what are we supposed to do, go run around and find everyone that had the source and everyone that had the binary? And he asked, you know, what in tarnation's a tarball? And I was just completely speechless at that. For those of you who don't know, a tarball in the Unix land is similar to a zip file where you compress files and you can pass it around with less bandwidth. And so here's the lawyer writing pieces of legislation that affect the majority of technology, and he doesn't understand the difference between source code, executables, or a compressed file format. And that was really scary. And I think that goes to illustrate how the legal system and the lawyers are really having a hard time with this, and it's going to be a very difficult fight, and we've seen that in the courtrooms. If you're interested in supporting financial donations to the EFF is really in need of cash donations. EFF is supporting the Maine, California case. They're also supporting the Maine case in New York, which at this time is probably the more important of the two. Public perception is kind of a difficult thing to rally up and gather. But one of the things I've been fighting in my case is the idea that the judge and the opposing lawyers have painted a picture of me of being an anarchist or a hacker or some guy going after the credit card numbers on Amazon.com, when in fact that's totally the opposite. This whole hacker image and the whole pirate idea that they put into the judges has been something that's been very difficult for us to overcome. And the fact that the motion picture industry chose a magazine such as 2600, it really shows they knew what they were doing. And, of course, you can write letters to Congress. At this time, there's really only one representative that's looking at changing parts of the DMCA. It's a representative in West Virginia or Virginia, I believe. I forgot his name. I'm sure someone here remembers if they want to talk, tell everyone later. For defense funding, talk a little bit briefly about how my case is a little different. I was served in the California case along with several hundred other defendants. Since being served, I spun off a side fight on the basis of jurisdiction. Since the case was filed in a state court in California, I didn't feel that I fell under the jurisdiction of the court in that state. I was a student in Indiana at the time, and I live in Dallas now. And so I posed the question to the court, you know, how can I be punished under the, or how can I be served under the California court while not even living in California or falling under the jurisdictional laws that exist for California. This case has been privately funded. I funded the entire fight. The original argument was a motion to quash on the basis of jurisdiction. The hearing there was denied by the judge. We appealed that ruling. That ruling was denied. We then presented it to the state Supreme Court there in California. Luckily, they heard the case. The state Supreme Court hears less than 10% of all cases that are posed to it. So we thought it was very good that the state Supreme Court found that this is a very interesting case. The state Supreme Court came back with a ruling unanimously in my favor, telling the lower court that they needed to show cause. This can kind of be seen as two ways. One, the Supreme Court giving the appeals court one last time to save face. Or secondly, they really did not get the arguments that the plaintiffs or the court was saying, and they wanted the court to make clearer arguments as to why I should be served under California's jurisdiction. So that was sent down to the appeals court. The appeal court, in turn, this was about a month ago, denied, again, my request. And so right now we're looking at going back to the state Supreme Court. And the funding for that is what I'm looking for now. The EFF can also be found at www.eff.org. They're looking for members and donations. They're supporting the main case in California and also the New York case. Thank you. One of our biggest problems was actually generating big money. The motion picture industry and the recording industry have bottomless pockets to throw at this, and we're fighting mostly on personal donations. Companies that are starting to get into Linux, such as Compaq and IBM, or even some of the smaller ones, really need to step up and say, hey, you know, we understand what's going on here. We need to change it. We're not necessarily looking for full approval or full agreement. I know that would be something that be very difficult for an IBM or a Compaq to do, but support in the form of, you know, hey, let's take a look at the laws and the way they are. With all the cases and litigation that's going on, it's obvious that these laws aren't working. And so that's what we're in need of more, is really big support, big in the name of, in the sense of public perception and also in dollars. Now I'd like to open up to questions. I'd like to start off with technical questions, then we can kind of move over to the legal ones. So if anyone has any technical ones, we'll start with there.
So I got a modern Sony camcorder, digital DV, this summer. What format comes out of that DV wire?
It's actually it's called DV. Format's actually called DV, yeah.
The spec Libre?
I'm sorry?
Is the spec
Libre?
Yeah.
Quasi. There is support out there for that, though. The FireWire project on SourceForge has drivers for your FireWire card, and you also support sucking in from DV. And there's also a guy that was looking to join our project that has written a DV player, and I even think there's some software in there for editing. There is. With Broadcast 2000, the author of Broadcast 2000 added DV support for editing, so you've got support for it.
I've already done some editing with the iMovie that came with my mom and dad's Macintosh G4. Is there any hope to get from QuickTime back into something that's more free?
I'm not familiar with iMovie all the way. Is there output format?
It spews out QuickTime, but it pains me to put QuickTime on the web. I'd rather be putting something freer.
I understand.
And I've already done this editing.
Yeah, the problem with QuickTime, obviously, is a Sorensen patent, or the patent on part of the compression that's done with QuickTime. The guy that wrote Broadcast 2000 has some support for QuickTime. I don't know up to what version of QuickTime there is support for. I do not know if Broadcast 2000 can input QuickTime and then output something else. That's something you might want to look into with Broadcast 2000.
Maybe we can capture it as it's being put on the screen somehow and then recompress it.
Yeah, an XV driver would work.
Yeah. Cool.
XV
Thanks.
Capture driver. Any other technical questions? All right, you guys want to talk anything about the legal stuff?
One more technical. Which video card do you have, and what kind of frame rate do you get, both with sound and without?
This is an ATI Rage Pro 64. I've got a Pentium 3 650 megahertz on here. I did not run any time demos with Zine. Zine was getting a little bit better frame rate than OMS was at this time. With the XV support coming into the newer versions of X-Free, we're seeing full frame rates with any chipset that has XV support, any modern one, anything a little bit better than a Rage 64, any of your NVIDIAs, any of your Matrox, your 3DFXs. On a 450 or 500 megahertz processor, you'll be able to get full frame rate without skipping with audio.
Excellent.
So that's about 30 frames per second with audio and everything that goes into that. But don't try to encode MP3s or play Quake at the same time.
Do you see decent support right now for capture cards, particularly without dropping frames and that kind of thing?
There is support. There's modern support for a couple cards. There's one that got into the kernel. I forgot the name of it. I haven't actually seen any of the capture ones. The BTTVs can do okay capture. I haven't seen anything recently. I've got a BTTV card, and I haven't run a newer version of Broadcast 2000 on it to really give you a good idea of how it stores. I do know that I can do full-screen television without a problem and things like that. That's a very interesting question. I'm afraid I just haven't looked at the software or any of the, I don't have much capture hardware. Yeah. If you find someone who wants to send it to me, I'll answer your question. Yeah, the question was you got to go to 2.4, and I would definitely recommend going to the kernel 2.4 or the version 2.4 of the Linux kernel for better video support. A really neat project that's going on now is the KIO buffs, and this, what this will allow us to do, this will be in 2.5 and eventually 2.6 or 3.0. One of the problems with video capturing is you want a large continuous piece of memory to store everything, but unfortunately the Linux kernel doesn't really like you to do that. If you're familiar with the AGP hardware, what AGP does is it'll map areas of memory and make it look like one continuous block, but then handle the appropriate memory operations, and it'll still be fragmented memory. The KIO buffs want to implement what AGP does in hardware in software, so now we have an interface for continuous memory space that the kernel handles itself, and so this is really going to help video on Linux. I've seen some of the beta patches out for it. I haven't had a chance to try it, but this should be in 2.5 when 2.5 starts rolling out.
I said I was looking for an excuse to upgrade. Now I've got one.
2.4 also adds better support for X. When you go to X4, you'll get better performance with the XV extensions.
How is KIO going to differ from something like, say, just a really big RAM disk?
Like a really big RAM disk?
Yeah, like a 256 meg RAM disk all allocated at once.
The difference is when you do a RAM disk, you're setting that memory space aside for good. With KIO buffs, it's dynamic. So we can allocate it, use it, and then free it. Okay. And the kernel will give it all back. With a RAM disk, it would take a reboot for you to get that memory back. So it's better from a standpoint that you're much more flexible. There's also going to be some features added into KIO buffs. I haven't seen the full spec list, but it'll be much better than just having like a big RAM disk. As far as performance, we'll have to see how that goes. I'm sure there might be a point to where a big RAM disk would be better performance. We'll have to wait and see. Any other questions?
Yep. Do you have any different optimizations for your different hardware architectures in your CPU?
Yeah, we do. The question was, do we have any other hardware accelerations depending on your CPU? And yeah, we do. We've got support for MMX, which will span all your Intel and your AMD hardware. Patches came in recently for MVI instructions. For any of you that have Alpha hardware, MVI is really cool. MVI is like MMX on crack and steroids and everything else. You can do full rate encoding of MPEG-1 just using the MVI extensions on the Alpha. And so those extensions are being taken advantage of. There was also some people looking into the SSE extensions. And then there's some stuff you can do on PowerPC. I'm not sure what it was. But I don't recommend Spark for video. Spark's not a very good architecture for video at this point. I haven't seen anything that shows that it's there's no real benefit for using Spark architecture in doing video encoding or decoding.
What kind of decoding time are we looking at on or gigahertz machine?
On a gigahertz machine, are you just looking to play DVD, or do you want to decode the entire thing?
Decode it.
If you decoded it without display, I'd have to. I don't have a really good number for you. If you're decoding without display, you're gonna go really fast. Probably one and a half or two times faster than if you were playing it. That'd just be off the top of my head. And then if you add a gigahertz over 500 megahertz, you get an advantage there. That's an interesting question. I'd like to see someone do that with numbers. But with the current libraries and the optimizations, it'd be really good. Any legal questions on the case?
I'm not completely familiar with your case, but have you had any kind of legal abuse played on you or any of the members of your team as a result of any of this?
I'm sorry, the question, legal abuse?
As in people knocking on your door, Dimitri type things?
Oh, black coats and black helicopters? Nothing like that. Luckily, I've just been served papers and having to deal with this case. Nothing as Gestapo as what happened with Dimitri and the professor that was going to present the SDMI papers. I don't know if any of my other members of my team, a lot of them have gone underground and just quit working and silenced up just zipped up, gone away. So I haven't heard anything from anyone else. Derek Falkus, one of the early developers in England, has also filed a motion to quash based on jurisdiction. The idea is he's in England. How can he be tried in a court in California? So we'll see how that goes. I do know he early on, he received some letters, cease and desist letters, but we haven't seen anything as volatile or as nasty as what happened to Dimitri. I was actually at the conference, at DEF CON. I was a backup speaker at DEF CON when Dimitri got arrested, and now I'm kind of glad that I didn't get a chance to go on.
Do they want to prosecute you in California as opposed to the state where you live and work, and just because a judge there is more sympathetic to the industry?
Probably. Venue shopping, they clearly venue shop for New York, and they've got a lot of favor in California. So that's more than likely. What we have to understand is for them, they really don't care about the technical aspects of this case. We can tech them to death, showing how they're never going to, this is never going to work, this isn't going to happen. But what they're really good at is setting precedent, getting judges to do things, and setting the legal scenario up that it makes it very difficult for us to defeat it. And that's where they're much better. And it's a much harder fight to fight that than it is to come in on the technical side. And so we're really having to go into their arena and fight their battle, which has been very difficult.
I had thought and heard that the main legal crux of all of this was the method that the DACS S was obtained, with that, whatever it was, Samsung decoder or something like that, that they had looked at. But apparently, by what you've said in the presentation, there are quite a few other aspects. Like you said, the video editing and that kind of stuff is legally suspect or whatever. At least they're looking at it, something like that. Just how far does this legal stuff span across the entire video and editing and that kind of stuff?
Maybe I wasn't a little clear earlier. Their main concern really is just the DECSS or maintaining the sanity of the CSS process, which gives them the access control and the copy control that they think they have. That's what they're more concerned about. They're really not concerned about the editing. They're really not concerned about playing really in general. What they're really concerned about is that DECSS or CSS decryption is out there and available for everyone to do. So that's the main justification for their case, is they're playing up the dissemination of trade secrets and the violation of the DMCA on the basis of circumvention of copy protection.
No, I'd heard also recently, I think it was on Slashdot or something, that there was another method of decoding that somebody had come up by fully reverse engineering, which apparently is legal and all that kind of stuff. Do you know anything about that, or is that still within what they're looking at?
Yeah, there have been what they call clean room implementations of CSS and DECSS. There are a lot of those out there, and I haven't seen anything that shows that the motion picture industry is actually going after those efforts. But that doesn't help us a lot. We have the technical ways to get around them. The fact that Linux did not have a commercially available DVD player under the DMCAA apparently is reason enough for us to be able to reverse engineer it or get around it. The DMCA has provisions, and this helps people like in our situation where the motion picture industry says, we're not going to make a DVD player for Linux, so instead of locking out people on that platform, since we don't have a commercially available one, the DMCA or the portion of it says you're allowed to reverse engineer for interoperability. So in that sense, we thought we were in the right. Unfortunately, Judge Kaplan in New York did not agree. And so the fact that we've got technical tweaks to get around what they're saying doesn't help us. It's the legal battle and the way they're setting precedent and the way they have the judges interpreting the laws as to why we're losing.
Yeah, it just sounds absolutely insane. Just for using it, you get beaten up.
Yeah. Right, and which that brings up another point you said, with just because you're using it. DECSS is a lot different than Napster, whereas Napster, if you're using Napster, it really has one purpose, and that's removing songs. Napster wasn't designed or built generic enough to where you can make it just a general file transfer program. DECS, however, has legitimate, making a DVD player for Linux uses, and potential illegitimate, making illegal or distributing illegal copies. What we've seen now is judges saying you're not even allowed to have something that could possibly be used for wrong. And that's kind of a scary precedent to set. And this isn't anything we want to see in computing, especially when it comes to cryptography research. We can't analyze why the CSS algorithm is poor. We can't analyze why the SDMI encryption scheme was bad. The fact that encryption doesn't even apply to content protection hasn't seemed to sunk into their heads anyway. And so those are the really scary things with the precedent if they get it set.
Yeah, great, thanks.
I'm sorry, what was the question? Right, he made a point that a car could be used in a commission of a crime if you use a
cars, right.
Right, yeah, if you use a car to make a getaway from a bank or run over eight people, is it the cars we need to outlaw or the people using the car in that method? And that's really where I fully agree. I mean, if there are people using software and spreading copies of DVD movies out on the internet or making wholesale batch copies, I agree they should be going after those people, not the people developing software for legitimate purposes.
What is their argument that you have jurisdiction in the state of California?
I haven't seen a clear reason, but somehow they've managed to convince a panel of judge twice and three other judges. In fact, in the last appeal, none of the judges on the appellate panel even brought up questions about jurisdiction or even talked about the law. At one point, my attorney was going back and forth with one of the judges because he could not understand the question the judge was asking. And it basically came down, the judge was asking, what did Matt do? And that's what we're going against. It's really mind-numbing. I kind of get this, the idea in my head comes that just take a cold iron, like an iron you put in your freezer for, iron your clothes and put in your freezer, and then stick it to your brain. And that's what this is like.
Thanks.
He brought up a good point, though, on what they're trying to claim. One of the things we're really worried about is if this precedent gets set, anyone in California would be able to sue or serve anybody in the country or in the world, and there would be a precedent set that they could argue, hey, they did stuff on the Internet. The Internet's in California. We can get anybody from California. It's kind of scary.
So for what they're trying to go after you with, if they're going to do the DMCA,
It's a California law. It's actually the question was, are they going after me for the DMCA or a California-specific law? And the answer is a California-specific law. It's misappropriation of trade secrets, which that brings up a whole nice other avenue with trade secret and dissemination. Generally, the only person you can go after is the person that originally did the dissemination. It's kind of funny that they can even still proceed with this case when the source code for DECSS was submitted as evidence in the trial and was in public record for 5 days.
So for, let me think of my question here. I had another one for you. So wouldn't the worst be that you could just say, well, fine, I just never go to California again the rest of my life? See ya, you know?
No, they can seek financial damages, and I'd be forced to pay those.
This is so surreal. I can't even find words for it.
Yeah. Welcome to my last 2 years.
Yeah, back to my my home video stuff, and you had the slide talking about, you know, trying to make open players and open standards for some kind of CD or DVD-like storage. Are there any legal encumbrances on that look like they're going to be difficult to get over, or can that part of the project go smoothly?
I don't see any technical reasons why we can't do that. Really neat projects like OGG. I don't know if anyone's familiar or if everyone's familiar with it. OGG or OGG is a replacement for MP3 formats. And so what they've created was another compression algorithm that isn't bound by any copyright or patent. And we want to take that concept and apply it towards video and audio and actually create a full suite of tools that go into that. So, yeah, we'd like to see that. I mean, that would be just fantastic if we could get that done.
In terms of freedom overall, is America still the most free country as far as this type of legal situation is concerned? I mean, we have a problem with the legal system, it seems.
Yeah, what we found is the legal system is broke in this scenario. This case brings up so many aspects of the law all in one nice one-by-one box that it's been very difficult to, you know, get people to understand it. Unfortunately, our legal system moves a little bit slower than society in general, which kind of moves pretty slow, but technology is moving at light speed compared to the both of those.
What about other countries?
Other countries, the DMCA is an implementation of a WIPO treaty, which is the World Intellectual Property Organization. Any country that is not or has not enacted a WIPO treaty would be considered more free in this sense that there isn't a DMCA to have to fight. It was brought up yesterday that Russia and China would actually be more free in this sense. So that spurred the comment that, you know, to find freedom in technology, you got to move to a communist country.
So they're just falling in line.
I'm sorry?
They're just falling in line behind the U.S.
Right.
Pretty much.
Yeah, many other countries. Canada is looking at implementing a DMCA-like law. Australia is as well. So it's a scary thing. When you're looking at the corporations that are pushing these organizations like the WTO and the WIPO, there's very little normal people can do about it. So hopefully we can, you know, knock some of the precedents down or knock some sense into our legislators to say, hey, this isn't something we need to be doing. Another interesting point, the Livid project is and always has been hosted in Germany, and most of our developers are international. So that brings up another question is how they can, you know, just target me or try to shut down a project that, you know, doesn't even exist in the U.S. And I haven't written a line of code applicable to CSS or DECSS at all. Any other questions? Sure.
Perhaps I'm misunderstanding it, but isn't the basis of trade secrets is if it's been legitimately opened or cracked, then you lose all protection for trade secrets? Because you're gaining the fact that you don't have to reveal it, but as soon as someone legitimately gets it, you lose the right to all rights to it versus a patent where it's out in the open, but you have rights to it.
That's my understanding of trade secret as well. And that also brings up to the point why they could not patent CSS was because if they patented it, there would have been a clear description of how to implement it. So the fact that they're going after trade secret doesn't make any sense at all.
So they're trying to have their cake and eat it, too, because they want it to be secret, not tell anyone, yet they want all the protection of patents, even though I could be wrong, but it doesn't sound like they have any legal basis. So once it's been reverse-engineered in a clean room approach, they shouldn't have any basis at all. Am I right?
That's my understanding. And this kind of goes back to the fact that that's like a technicality where we understand that and we know that, you know, the source code to CSS or how to CSS isn't going to go away. But where they have the upper arm is venue shopping, convincing judges to say things and, you know, pass judgments. This is pretty scary because things like this, a lot of people understand, you know, how it's right and, you know, where it should go. But unfortunately, these things move really slow. So, I mean, it could be another 10 or 20 years before we see this reversed.
Well, the thing that bothers me, it's not really a technical issue at that point because, you know, trade secret versus patent, that's covered, like, in the first week in a business law class, which judges and lawyers, that should be their field. I mean, they should know that as part of their job.
Right. But once you throw in the word computer, the thinking goes all over the place. The judges are like, I don't get this, you know. They don't understand how to apply normal things like physical laws to virtual or internet or cyberspace. And that's where we've had the problem. The other thing is the perception that, you know, the opposing attorneys point to me and they say, there's hacker, there's, you know, credit card thief. And the judge is like, okay, yeah, I read about them on CNN. You know, that's him. That's one of them. You know, and I'm looking at him like, okay, I'm an Eagle Scout. My dad was in the Air Force, fought in Vietnam. My grandfather worked on the Manhattan Project. My other grandfather was in the Navy intelligence. And I try to look at him like, okay, how am I an anarchist or unpatriotic? And it kind of boils me.
Kind of like stockbrokers in the dot-com fiasco. Because they didn't research the businesses. They just threw money at computers.
Exactly. That same kind of thought.
Other questions? I don't want to hog the mic here, seriously.
Yeah, you got it. Go for it.
Oh, I'm done.
Okay.
So has there been any legal fighting going on in any other countries other than here? Or is it just people in California trying to sue everybody else in the world? Or, I mean, there's big film industries in, like, Japan and Hong Kong and Europe. Have any of the companies around there, like, joined in this with the MPAA? And tried to go after you guys?
I haven't seen anything. There was a case against John Johannesson in Norway. That was pretty Gestapo. They kind of busted in, took his cell phone charger. No, wait, they came back for his cell phone charger. Anyway, they took his computers and all this other stuff. And that was pretty unpopular in Norway. And, you know, luckily all that kind of went away. We haven't seen, you know, anything, you know, in Europe or in East Asia yet. Most of it has been the New York case, which is a federal case in which the motion picture industry was suing 2600 for posting the code, and then the case in California, which is now split into two parts, my part, which is the jurisdictional, and then the main piece, which is the dissemination of trade secrets. Does that answer your question?
The EFF, I'm not very familiar with, but is that specifically to your case and the New York case, or is that a general type of thing? I mean, this DACSS is just one step on what seems to be, somebody gets a nip or a foot in the door, and after that can just be absolutely disastrous, and I'm sure there are lots of other things there. Is there any organization, or is that what the EFF is working on putting some front to this insanity?
That's it. The EFF is our one organized front. EFF is the Electronic Frontiers Foundation. It was founded by John Gilmore, who is the fifth employee at Sun. Their biggest case that they won before was the Betamax case several years ago. Since then, their presence in Washington, D.C. had kind of dwindled, and they still don't have any real press or any presence there in D.C. And then they started getting in on the DECSS fight, the Napster fight, the Dimitri case, and the professor that had broken the SDMI challenge. The EFF is a great organization. We've got some great lawyers working with that. They're supporting the New York case. They're supporting the main California case. And unfortunately, like I was talking before, the one thing we don't have is the bottomless pockets. And this is a very confusing topic, and it's very technical. It's very in-depth. You've got to sit and listen and follow things for, you know, 15, 20 minutes before you understand it. So it's very hard to, you know, send a one-liner that says, you know, why this is wrong. And, you know, things like the hacker image and all those things are really kind of getting in the way of us getting general public support.
Yeah, I'm curious, in these trial proceedings, is it are technical details really discussed? I mean, is that something that the judges and lawyers and everything get into, or is it really more of a general type of argument that goes on?
The technical discussions did go on. I was an expert witness and a fact witness in the New York case, and that was one of my main jobs, was to go in and explain all the technical aspects and the technical details as to why, you know, why we needed to reverse engineer the whole interoperability argument. And so all that was discussed. Unfortunately, I don't think any of it soaked in.
It falls on deaf ears.
Go ahead.
Right, I was going to say, perhaps the judges might understand the analogy. If you take the automobile industry, for example, there's nothing illegal about Ford buying a Mercedes and tearing it down to see how it works. They do that sort of thing all the time, and it's not illegal. And yet, if you want to do the equivalent in the computer industry, suddenly it's illegal.
Right. We argued the same thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, we came up with analogies. We came up with, you know, hey, look, there is no, and at the time, there still isn't really a widespread commercially available Linux DVD player. And that was one of our bigger technical arguments, especially when it comes to reverse engineering. And what the opposing lawyers argued was that the RE for interoperability doesn't apply. And the judge said, okay, apparently.
Okay.
Yeah, fun stuff. So, yeah, you can see what we've been going up against. And, you know, we bring up all the technical aspects and we bring up, you know, this is the reality of technology piece. And it doesn't really, it hasn't been effective. One of the points I made yesterday was something the motion picture industry and the recording industry, I think, fail to see is that there's nothing forcing them to use digital content. There's nothing saying you have to produce digital or movies digitally or audio digitally. That's something they chose. So they came into an environment which they really did not know a lot about, and instead of going in and understanding the best way to approach this market, they went in and said, well, we'll just try to build you know, laws and all this other protection around and redefine what copyright is and all this other stuff. And so no matter what goes on in tech world, we're fine. And it's been very difficult. At one point, I heard the comment that we'll just firewall the internet everywhere. We're going to firewall DECSS everywhere. And it just goes to show that, you know, they really don't understand
the new
Great
Wall of China.
I'm sorry?
The new Great Wall of China.
Yeah, the new Great Wall of China, exactly, that we're just going to firewall everything and no one will be able to move DECSS around. Or I had no idea what he was thinking.
Yeah, I never thought, given that the DMCA, in effect, preempts fair use, would there be any other organizations that might be interested in maybe approaching that angle besides EFF?
Originally, we had talked with the ACLU.
Yeah.
We actually did. Mm-hmm. When I was at that convention in New York in February, we had a great panel together. We had some of the leaders of VA Linux. We had an executive, I don't know if it was vice president of the ACLU, sat in with us. We had our legal team. We sat down and we really came up with a good strategy. And a lot of that depended on getting corporate dollars and support from the ACLU. And unfortunately, we didn't get the corporate dollars or the support from the ACLU. And so a lot of it kind of went back down to the grassroots effort, and that's kind of where we've been since. The other fun thing in New York was trying to find a intellectual property attorney that had not worked for the motion picture industry or the recording industry. If you're an intellectual property attorney, more than likely you have worked a case for one or two of those companies that were involved.
Are your case transcripts available, like if we need a laugh or something?
Yeah, all the case transcripts are available for a laugh.
Do you have them online?
Yeah, they're all online. You can get, most of them are available at EFF.org. There's also cryptome.org. That's CRYPTOME.org. A lot of the good case transcripts there. Good ones to read probably would have been the last ruling against myself from the appellate court, Jack Valeni's interview. Jack Valenti is the head of the MPAA in the New York case. That was a good one to read. And then Kaplan's ruling, Judge Kaplan's ruling on the New York case. Those got some fun reading in there.
Now you mentioned one senator that was on your side, or
I think it's a representative, and I think his name is like Rick Doucher, D-O-U-C-H. I'm sorry?
It wouldn't be Santorum. I know there's a Rick Santorum.
No, I don't think that. I think he's in Virginia or West Virginia. I think he's just a representative. I don't think he's a senator. He's kind of brought it up. He's more likely a minor senator or kind of low in the political totem pole. So what we really need to do is get someone like a Dick Armey or a Rich Gephardt or somebody like that on our side to really garner support.
But who might be a target?
I've got someone in mind, but I'm not going to talk about it right now. I'll if we get there, you'll hear news posts about it.
Yeah, just on the set of threats, John Gilmore sent out a letter in this past year about how patents are going to be added to the arsenal. I mean, you're going up against the DCMA and its provisions or whatever, and even though it's got reverse engineering as an excuse, it's being ignored. I think when it comes to patents, like the next set of encryption used in this kind of player technology, well, the encryption and the decryption will be patented, and you're not going to have a license to, you know, to publish a piece of software that decodes it. And there's probably not a reverse engineering provision for patents, you know, that you're going to make it work on some other device.
Right. If you've got a patent, it's pretty much game over.
And even though the encryption's really, really weak, it doesn't matter because it is patented. And the general public at large still loves patents. I mean, you can talk about fair use and all this, and people think libraries are a pretty cool idea.
Right.
But when it comes to patents, they're not even going to consider the idea that patents are bad.
Right. And this is actually an area where just recently I've kind of changed my position on it. I was actually talking with an intellectual property and a software patent attorney when I was at DEF CON, and we talked for hours about it. I'm not against software patents. I think that in some cases there's actually a place where it fits and where it makes sense if you're actually coming up with an original idea, original process. And this kind of goes back to the function aspect of programs. What I do have a problem with is the currently issued patents for software, where you get too general, where you say, I have a one click on my website and now you're done shopping patent. That's not specific enough. I mean, I want to see something, you know, a low-level memory management routine. I want to see, you know, something very, very specific, very general, and something that is not just a math formula implemented with computer code. Math formulas are open and out there, and if you implement with computer code, I don't understand how that could be patented. And that's where I think the patent office has a shortcoming with technology as well. But you're exactly right. The companies are going to be coming around with patents. They're going to be coming around with all these, you know, they're going to extend patent and copyright law to, they're going to mold it to what they want. And what they want is a pay per each use of a copy. They want you to pay for each time you read a copy of, you know, The Hobbit, or each time you watch a Matrix. They want their token, you know, for you doing that. And that's the model they want. And they think they can get it. And that's kind of a difficult thing.
That's what Microsoft's trying to pull now with the XP.
Exactly, same thing. Instead of coming up with good ideas and ways to extend your business model or hit new markets, they're just trying to, you know, bully their way into holding what they've got. I went into a little bit yesterday. I don't think I was very clear about it. One thing I see with the internet that's very interesting is you've got the ability to really reach very specific groups of people. If you have an artist that normally would not reach mainstream acceptance, instead of having the need to sell 100,000 copies of a record for that artist to continue, you know, making a living playing music, that number can drop down to something like 10,000. And the internet is a much easier way to reach that audience or those groups than any other traditional fashion. Whereas before, you'd have to tour the entire United States. You know, you sell 10,000 records, you're not going to cover your gas. With the internet, you can hit, you know, a specific group. You know, if someone likes Star Wars and Tool or something like that, they're going to like this kind of music. So you can really sculpt and gear how you want to market and push new content. I bring up the analogy. I'm a huge Pearl Jam fan. They recently released an album for every show in their last tour, and now I've got 73 copies. 73 CDs of every show that they did in their last tour. And it's along those lines. And you can do the same thing with independent movies and new artists and things like that. And the internet gives you the delivery mechanism that you did not have before to hit those small groups. This is kind of creating like cult brands. And while I don't think that this is going to produce enough money for them to offset, you know, what they're currently getting now, I think this is a step in the right direction and something that they should look into.
I have a question about region encoding, and it's both the technical and legal question, more of like region encoding and how the DMCA is applied to that, and how the LIVID project is overcoming or working with the region encoding and the RCE disks.
The question was about region encoding, and I didn't go into this kind of on purpose. It's pretty in-depth, and it's really, there's a lot of ifs and gray area about it. What region coding is in DVDs and in the specification, what you have is you have this idea of labeling a disc and a player, meaning that this player should only live in this region, and the regions are broken up globally. I think the numbers are 7 regions around the world. So you've got a player that'll get a region identification, and then a DVD movie, which will get a region identification. And part of the DVD process when you're playing a movie is that you're supposed to check the drive and the disc match, meaning you've got a Region 1 player and a Region 1 movie. And if you do, okay, we're ready to go. This is a way that they could protect sales in regions. I have no idea. There's a lot of claiming that this is in violation of a lot of WTO treaties. There's a lot of people arguing that, you know, if I buy a movie in England, I can't play it on my U.S. player. You know, the question about U.S. soldiers abroad, you know, if they buy a player in the United States, like a little handheld player, and, you know, now they're stationed in Japan or they're stationed in Germany, they can't play their discs on their player. With computer drives, there are 2 types of DVD drives. There's RPC-1 and then RPC-2. RPC-1 relies on the DVD player to do the region checking. RPC-2 drives do the region check themselves. With Region 1 or RPC-1 drives, it's very easy to overcome that. Basically, we say, give me your disk, whatever region you have, we'll play it, not a problem. With Region 2, it's more difficult because the drive does the check for you. Many DVD drive manufacturers have released firmware updates for RPC-2 drives that overcome that, basically saying, let's go back to the way we were before. This isn't very popular among consumers for, you know, obvious reasons. It's, you know, very Big Brother-ish, very, you know, restrictive in what you can do. But that's how we take care of it on the software side.
One thing that I can't help but notice with everything that, the entire legal direction that, like, the MPAA and the RIAA are trying to go to is ultimately this sort of pay-per-view world, you know. Well, I'll try to keep my question short here, but the 2 examples that I'm trying to think of where they actually did try to do a pay-per-view where it won't really, you know, translate was like Circuit City when they did the DivX players and how those never really took off because, okay, I go ahead and I buy the DivX CD, I can play it on my own machine, I can even pay for it, but, you know, good luck letting my sister across town borrow it and go ahead and watch, you know, whatever movie. Between that and I'm trying to think of whatever... What's the other example I was thinking of? Like with the e-books, you know, like Adobe e-books, same sort of thing. You buy it, and even if they let you pay for it in some fashion, you can never really share it with anyone else, so those haven't really take off. So my question for you is, like, for what you've seen so far, even if they can legally force this sort of pay-per-view world to happen, do you ultimately think that it would stand up? Do you think consumers would really go for it long-term?
I don't think consumers would. Consumers are used to being able to buy a DVD or buy a CD or buy a book and give it to their friend, read it 3 times. And I don't think consumers are really going to take to this. And I think this is going to be their first real short falling with doing this major push to digital content, especially with like ebooks. The advantage of doing like ebooks or having a portable DVD player or digital audio that's in a compressed format, is it's just another way for you to use that content or view it. It's an auxiliary method. It's kind of like when radio came out, you know, or I'm sorry, TV came out, and people were like, well, radio's going to go away. what really happened was radio became more prominent or more specialized. You know, now the internet's out. Well, TV's coming more specialized. So even radio now is going to be moving to satellite-based subscription. You're going to have far more content than you ever had over the radio. And it's going to be the same thing with, like, these, you know, e-books and players and audio players, where it's just another way for people to enjoy their music, and another method they can carry it around and you know, use it. And so I don't think that people are going to go for this pay-per-view model. I don't think we've seen the right model yet. Obviously, it's going to be very difficult to come up with a happy medium. Subscription services don't sit well with consumers. They're always going to have that, you know, June, July, I didn't read a book at all. You know, why am I paying $10 a month to Amazon? And, you know, so I think that's where it'll go.
How do you see the manufacturers working with, like, the MPAA and the people that want to restrict it? Because I noticed originally they'd play, the manufacturers would create a player that'll play anything, and then when they started doing the SDMI talks, then the manufacturers started talking like they were going to put some stuff in there for that, and then as soon as that sort of got lost in the mix, then they went back to making, every major manufacturer made like a car MP3 CD player all of a sudden, even though they were trying to block that originally. Same, I'm noticing the same with DVD players now, because you can go on the net and you can find region-free DVD players from major manufacturers pretty easily, so you don't have to worry about the region encoding. So are the manufacturers just basically trying to make a buck anywhere they can and not really caring about the argument? And do you see them maybe doing the same thing with the DVD drives and actually just going ahead putting out region-free DVD drives for anybody?
Absolutely. The motion picture industry sees the consumer electronics industry as the really bad business partner. You know, we'll get an idea together, we'll go ahead and do all this stuff, we're like, yeah, but the manufacturers of electronic and consumer hardware, they know that consumers push their product lines, they know that consumer demand will always win. You know, I think we saw this with CD writers, we're going to see this with DVD writers, they finally settled on a spec. Consumer demand always pushes the products. And the motion picture industry, and let's call them the entertainment industry. They've always had a nice, cozy, you know, monopoly. We can just push this mass accepted movie or this mass media to everybody, and everyone's going to like it, and they're going to come and spend their $7 at a movie. And they've really never had to really come up with really smart or new business models or new approaches. It really hasn't changed since, you know, the very early days. And so I think the consumer electronics industry are going to do whatever they want. I think they're going to do what consumers want, which I think is really the basis for capitalism.
But quick comment. It's just really simple. Manufacturers are practical. Consumers pay that, get them profits. Media people don't.
Exactly, yeah. The comment was, you know, the consumers pay the bills for Sony and Toshiba. The motion picture industry doesn't. Yeah, and so I think that's absolutely what it'll be.
So even though the motion picture industry right now, they've got the legal part on their side so they can push us around, you don't see them being able to push the consumer electronics industry around the same way?
No. Here's the other funny thing. How is Sony going to sue themselves?
Yeah, exactly. I've always wondered about that. Sony was a member of the whole SDMI team, yet at the same time they're making CD MP3 players. I mean, they're pushing both sides of the fence.
Exactly. I mean, that's kind of the whole two-facedness to this whole thing. They're kind of upset that they didn't see it first. They're upset that they didn't get, you know, they weren't the first ones to, you know, music. And so they're kind of like, whoa, we can't have someone else, you know, cutting into our budgets. You know, so they kind of went after it. One of the things that they argued in the cases, it's kind of funny, was that open source software was really, you know, the philosophies were just to free everything and free content and open access without regards to anything. And the DVD CCA's own website runs Apache, which is an open source program. So does Universal Studios. So it kind of shows the two-faced nature of, you know, what's going on.
Another quick comment.
Sure.
On the regional encoding, I know it's slightly unrelated, but ties in the whole access control. I've heard of cases where you get DVD here for $30 U.S., and in India, in a different region, you can buy it for less than $2 U.S. I think what's scary in the movie people is that you can buy it in India, get it over here for less than half the cost. They're basically trying to set up artificial markets. And simple economics says that black markets happen because the consumer wants something producers aren't making it, therefore the market is going to correct it.
Exactly. I haven't heard those exact numbers, like dollar-wise, but it makes sense. Obviously, India's market isn't as, dollars and cents don't even up as well. The one point... Is it? The comment was on prescription drugs. The one thing I have seen, though, one of the big arguments with the region encoding or the region coding is that in Europe, if you buy a DVD movie, you just get the movie. All the extras and all those features, like the interviews or the alternate endings or behind the scenes things, those are only available on the U.S. versions. And so, if I'm in France and I want to get the full souped up version of a movie, I have to buy one from the U.S. because they don't offer that in Europe.
In June, they had an issue with the price of DVDs, and that was just hitting their media that, the consumers were starting to gripe that they were paying 50% more for DVDs than we were in the U.S.
Where was that? In London, they were paying 50% more?
Yeah, in England. And it was just coming into the media, and the consumers were starting to make waves about, why... do they have to pay $30 for something that's only $20 here?
Exactly, and the region coding protects that. They can do whatever they want with that. And that's where a lot of the discussion from consumers about region coding is boiled a lot of blood. An interesting fact, if you look back, when Napster was peaking, the recording industry and the record industry recorded record sales in albums. They sold more albums or made more money that year. They also broke the single, 1 or 2 week record of an album in the year that Napster was at its peak. And so I think that's something you have to look at when, we're talking about, the movie picture, the movie industry or the recording industry is they're losing their markets with the internet and the ability to spread things around. When they have a record breaking year, it's kind of hard for them to make that argument. I think we got to go here. Are we running out of time? Okay, one more question. Anyone that hadn't asked a question want to ask?
All right, go. One real quick comment. About earlier topic about why only the U.S. is really pushing this and pushing this sort of thing, not other countries. Like, it seems like the U.S., a lot of U.S. people for movies want to charge a very high price and not really give regard to the market. For Japanese and a lot of other markets, they seem to make it so cheap that you have to go to them because it's so much cheaper. Why go anywhere else? So it seems like they're playing good economics. We're not. I could be wrong, but that's what it looks like.
That's a good comment and a good argument. Yeah, and as the globalization of the economy happens, this will bring up interesting behaviors.
I'll just say, region coding has nothing to do with copy protection. All about is the excuse given. It's really to create segregated markets.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Region coding doesn't do anything for copy protection was the comment, and that's absolutely correct. All right, well, thank you for having me. I'll step out in the hall if anyone's got any more questions or comments. We can talk there.